We don't know exactly how old he was, but somewhere in his teens probably. He was very young compared to older people of those days, and we don't know exactly how old he was, but he was to be anointed as king. Yet he didn't take the kingship in that same day. It was at least 13 years later, at least, and it probably was more. Now, when David is a lad, we don't know if he was 12, we don't know if he was 17, about the time that he killed the giant Goliath, but somewhere in there, perhaps. Then when he was put into the place of prestige in Saul's court and became Saul's armor bearer, he was there probably 3 years. And then Saul took out after David in jealousy, and David fled from him all over the wilderness for 10 years. So it is at least 13 years between the day that he was anointed to be king and the day in which he became king. And mind you, even when he became king, he wasn't king of all Israel. For 7 years, it was more warfare with northern Israel and those who opposed his being king. 7 more years, so 20 years from the time that he becomes anointed to the time that he becomes king, he goes through these difficult times. 7, the latter ones, he was recognized as king over Judah, the northern tribes, the southern tribes, but not king over all of Israel, including what was later called Israel, the northern tribes. Why all this weight? What was God doing in David's life? There are waiting periods that you and I have to go through sometimes. And we wonder, why is God making me wait? You know, the Bible says in the Old Testament, the steps of a good man are ordered of the Lord. Someone has said also, the stops of a good man are ordered of the Lord. The stops, and that's what David came to. I'll get something to weigh down my Bible so that I don't lose my place here with the wind, but it surely feels good coming in through the side door. The stops of a good man, ordered of the Lord. Well, these are some stops in David's life, and we want to see what God was doing during this time. According to our outline, we're looking at first Saul's attempts to destroy David. Why did Saul attempt to destroy David? Do you know offhand? If we boiled it down to one word, what is it? Jealousy. Jealousy. Now, David was the armor bearer of Saul, and he went out to war with him. It turned out that David was a good fighter, and the report would be heard back home concerning what David was doing out there on the front lines. And when they came back from the battlefield and they would come into the capital, the people would come out to exclaim how great Saul was. And Saul was used to that from the past. But now there was a different twist in the story. There was something new that was happening. Look at chapter 18, verses 5 to 9 of 1 Samuel. Chapter 18. Do you know what was different that was happening? Chapter 18, verse 5 of 1 Samuel. Whatever Saul sent him to do, David did it so successfully that Saul gave him a high rank in the army. This pleased all the people and Saul's officers as well. People were pleased with David. When the men were returning home after David had killed the Philistine, the women came out from all the towns of Israel to meet King Saul with singing and dancing, with joyful songs, and with tambourines and lutes. As they danced, they sang, "Saul has slain his thousands, and David his tens of thousands." Well, that didn't set very well with proud Saul. He was glad to hear them singing that he had slain his thousands, but he wasn't pleased to hear about their lauding David for his tens of thousands. They gave more credit to David than they gave to Saul. Well, something happened in Saul's heart that day when they came back. Jealousy stirred up in his heart, and he was never the same after that until his death, his dying day. He was jealous of David, and Saul thereafter sought David's life. That jealousy was mild at the beginning, but it built up higher and higher until one day David was singing for Saul, and Saul just couldn't stand the thoughts of it. Jealousy ate him up. And that's what jealousy does to us. Have you ever had jealousy of another person to eat within? There's only one thing that's going to cure it, and that is to confess it as sin and pray for that person that you're jealous about and establish a right heart attitude toward that person. I read a biography of F.B. Meyer last summer, and I noticed in the bookstore you have a number of books by F.B. Meyer, some biographies of the Old Testament characters, and you have some books by G. Campbell Morgan, both great writers who were contemporaries. And F.B. Meyer, in his biography, he's quoted as telling the story of his being in the same city with G. Campbell Morgan at one time, and he heard that the crowds were larger in attendance to Morgan's meetings, and something happened to F.B. Meyer. Now, we're all human, and F.B. Meyer, that great man of God, whom I've greatly admired for years, I love everything he's written, I read about his jealousy, and he said, I found that the cure did not come until I prayed for Morgan and for his meetings. And the interesting thing is, he found himself pastoring in the same city of London with G. Campbell Morgan, and the crowds were large at Morgan's church, and he had to pray the same thing. Now, they ran neck and neck as great men of God, but great men of God can experience the same thing, jealousy. David and Saul could experience it, but it wasn't David's problem, it was Saul's problem. Saul was the king, David wasn't. And David, or Saul, was jealous of David. And as a result, he went after David. And there was only one solution. If they are saying, I have word now that David is supposed to be king one day, there's only one way to assure myself that he'll not be king, and that's to rub him out, get rid of him, eliminate him. And Saul went after David. But David was faithful to God, and David would not harm Saul. He said, I'll not touch the Lord's anointed. Now, there are four times that we see different ways in which God used David. I forgot to put this on. I'm sorry. Is picking up okay? This way? All right, good. All right, we would like for you four now, each one in his own turn, just tell us about what means God used to save David's life. Tell us the story. First of all, row number one, 1 Samuel 19:8-10.
Can you read it?
Just tell us in your own words what God did.
What happened is there was a battle, and see, David and Michael, they just got married, and they're really in love with each other, and they were just starting their marriage, and David was kind of getting on a macho trip with all this battle thing, and he was getting right into it, and he came home this night, and he was sitting there playing a mandolin, and Saul was really jealous, and he threw his spear at him, but David just saw Michael walking by, and he just turned his head, and his spear just stuck in the wall beside him, and so he knew that he was in trouble then, so he had to flee, and Michael helped him.
All right, and that leads us to the next means that God used. It actually was David's quick reflexes that God used on one time. But the rest of the time, God used other means besides David's own action. The next story is in chapter 19, verses 11 to 17. All right, who?
Saul had sent a bunch of guys to surround David's house. And Michael saw him and said, "You better get out, or you're going to be dead by tonight." So what they did is they took the house idol, I don't know what that was, and they put like a goatskin hair on it and put it in the bed. And then they let, then Michael let David down by the rope through a window. Mm-hmm. And then the next day, that evening, they came and said, "Where's David?" And his wife said, "He's upstairs sick." Then they went and told Saul, so I said, "Well, go get him in his bed." They went up there and they saw his dummy in the bed. And so God used his wife to help him out there.
You brought out the matter of an idol. Evidently, Michael, probably in the Hebrew, the word would have been Michal, but we pronounced Michael was Saul's daughter who had been given in marriage to David, and she helped David escape. So God used David's quick reflexes. God used Michael to enable David to escape. The idols probably were idols that Michael held on to. She committed idolatry. She had never really gone 100% with Jehovah God. She held on to her idols. We may be like that sometimes, trying to hold on to the Lord with one hand while at the same time holding on to the idols of the world. We'll see this later in Michal when she doesn't rejoice with David in the good things that God is doing in his life, and she doesn't want him to give glory to Jehovah. All right, what did God use next in chapter 19, verses 18 to 24?
Well, David went to hide and fled and went to a place to hide at a place called Ramah, and Samuel was nearby that area. And Saul had heard about where he was and sent a bunch of men to capture him. And these men ran up into Saul and a bunch of other prophets, and they began to prophesy too. The Spirit of the Lord came along them. And so he sent some more guys, and the same thing happened. He finally went himself with some more men, and the Spirit of God came upon him and the other men, and they just got stuck prophesying, and they couldn't go on from there to look for him.
And the same thing happened to Saul himself. It's amazing that God should miraculously intervene in David's behalf in this way, that those who came out to fight against him, to capture him, to kill him, would end up prophesying in the name of the Lord. It was a special work that God performed in coming upon them and using those bodies for prophetical purposes, proclaiming the message of God rather than the opposite, going after the messenger of God and the workman of God, David. God used a miracle in that sense to save David. The point is, God can use anything He wants to, when He wants to, but He protects us when He has a plan that He's going to fulfill, and nothing can touch us without God's allowing it to. As long as He had a purpose for David to accomplish, nothing was going to harm David. What was the fourth means that God used? And what's the story in chapter 20? We've referred to this last night. Tell us about chapter 20, verses 11 to 42.
Jonathan and David made a covenant because of the friendship to look after each other's family if they died. And in this friendship, Jonathan agreed to find out whether Saul had anger or wanted to do harm against David. And if he sought to kill him, he would tell David beforehand to hide in a place. And when Jonathan would shoot three arrows past a certain point, if the boy that he sent out to get these arrows wouldn't come back with the arrows, then it wasn't safe for David to come back, and Saul was out for him and was going to kill him. And if it was safe for David to come back, then the lad would bring the arrows and come back. And it wasn't safe, and in that way David knew, and then they just bonded their agreement, their covenant that they made between each other.
Mm-hmm. God used Jonathan to spare David's life. It's interesting that God used two children of Saul, the enemy of David, to save David's life. Michal, his daughter, and Jonathan, his son. David was in constant peril,
And these are examples of what happened early in the experience, 19 and 20. Now, there are a number of chapters following this in which we'll see David out there in the wilderness. But what drove him away? It wasn't just one time throwing a javelin at him. That gave David a hint that something was wrong, right? When you have a javelin coming toward your head, you get suspicious. Well, when they came to kill him and they would stick a sword in a body lying in a bed, then you really know. Well, if that wasn't enough, there were other times. And down here he asked Jonathan, he says, "I'm near death itself." And Jonathan said, "No, I can't believe that." Jonathan was a little late in learning what Saul was after. But when he found out, he gave the sad word to David. And that was when David left and got out of there and went to another place to flee from Saul. And the rest of 10 years, David was in this cat and mouse chase game in which Saul was after him, here and there on this mountainside, on the other mountainside. One time, David, with his army of men that he had organized by then, they had been cast out by Saul, or for some, they were discontented with what Saul was doing, and some of them were rebels, and they came out and met David in the wilderness and said, "We're for you, not for Saul." And David built up an army. That's one thing God did in these 10 years. David was building up an army. Well, there was one occasion when Saul's army was coming after David, and David's army was fleeing from Saul, and each didn't know exactly where the other was. And if we could have been in a helicopter up in the sky, we would have looked down, and here was a ridge of a hill coming up this way. And on one side was David going that way, and on the other side, Saul was coming that way. So close, but neither knowing where the other was exactly. 10 years of this kind of chase, Saul was after David. But I like a statement someone has made: a man is immortal till his work be done. David was immortal till his work was to be done. God was going to use David. And though David fled from Saul during those 10 years, refusing to hurt Saul, God protected David. During this 10-year period, he met a woman named Abigail, who later became his wife. After her husband died, Abigail had a husband who was a stubborn kind of person and a selfish person. And though David, on one occasion with his men, had protected this man's men from the enemy, when David came around and asked for help, he said, "What do I owe you? I owe you nothing. Who are you?" And David thought he could have captured his whole family then and taken whatever he wanted and killed that man, Abigail's husband. But Abigail found out what had happened, and she pleaded for her husband. And that was her first contact with David. She came personally to meet David. Sometimes men don't know what they have to be thankful for in their wives and the good that they bring into their lives. I know how much I appreciate my wife and what she means to me and has always. This man's wife, Abigail, pleaded. And in her statement to David, she made a wonderful comment I'd like for us to see in 1 Samuel 25, verse 29. 1 Samuel 25, 29. She said this to David: "Even though someone is pursuing you to take your life, the life of my master will be bound securely in the bundle of the living by the Lord your God. But the lives of your enemies he will hurl away as from the pocket of a sling." Now notice, she recognized two places that a person is liable to be. One is, he's either bound in a bundle of God's care, comfort, and protection, or else he is set in a sling ready to be cast out. Where do we stand? In the Lord, we are bound in a bundle. That sling probably was familiar to David because he had used such a sling himself, you remember. And he would take that stone and put it in the pocket of the sling, which was a leather
belt-like rope, and he would sling it around, and then he knew just how to release it with the little whip, and the stone that had gained such force would go right toward the giant's brow and struck him between the eyes. Well, David knew what that stone represented and ready to be cast out at any moment. Well, that's the unsaved person, the one who doesn't know the care of God. And Abigail is telling him, David, you're like that, like the bundle. You are bound in a bundle of care and protection. Not set in a sling, but bound in a bundle. Your God is protecting you. So you don't need to do this to my husband. God is going to take care of you. She was pleading on her husband's behalf. And your enemies, and here she is saying, I know that someone is after you to take your life, but he's like one who's set in the pocket of a sling. God's going to take care of him. She was a wise woman. She knew what she was talking about. And that no doubt brought a word of comfort to David to have someone like that, an outsider, an objective bystander, to look at the two, Saul and David, and to make this evaluation of the situation. And what a comfort it is to us to know that when we're called of God, and when we're following Him, and when we're in the will of God, nothing can touch us but what first passes through the hand of God, the permissive will of God. We are bound in the bundle of His protective care. I read of a soldier somewhere in Europe who was fleeing from the enemy. This was a Christian man. And he was in an army, and he was separated from the rest of the soldiers. And the enemy soldiers were after him. And he went into a cave in a hillside and was hiding. And as he entered the cave, he noticed that a spider let itself down on a string of its web that it was about to weave. And it let itself down, and then it started crisscrossing, and it was making a spider web. And by the time that the enemy soldiers got to that cave, they went inside. One would go in one cave, one in another. They would call if they found the person. And a group started to come into this cave, and they saw that spider web there. And they left the cave and went on by. That spider web was as good as a 12-inch steel wall in protecting that soldier. Many times in David's life, God used what seemed to be just a spider web. There was just a step between David and death. But a spider's web was as good as a thick steel wall. God's protective hand was upon David. But it wasn't easy for David, fleeing from one place to another, fleeing from Saul. David, no doubt, asked sometimes, why is the Lord allowing this to happen? And you and I pass through why periods in our lives. But God can do for us through those why periods what He did for David during his why period. Now let's look at some of the things that David did in his attitude toward Saul. God's protective care of David is seen constantly. What about David's attitude toward Saul? Let's have a report on a couple of times that David spared Saul's life. Chapter 24 of 1 Samuel, verses 1 to 22.
After Saul and his men returning from, they were chasing the Philistines, was told that Saul told that David was in Engedi, wilderness of Engedi. He took 3,000 of his men.
Mm-hmm.
Went after him. That Saul went into this cave, and just so happened that David and his men were hiding in there. And while in there, David cut a piece of Saul's robe off, and but spared his life. And after Saul went out of the cave, David called after him and fell on the ground. I don't, as far I guess it's worshiping the king, and told Saul that he had, you know, proving to Saul he had nothing against him, and he wasn't looking to kill him. And Saul seemed to be grieved about that afterwards, and told David that he had treated him fairly while Saul himself had treated David wickedly. Mm-hmm.
But the amazing thing is, though Saul said, he seemed to give up and say, David, I was wrong. He repented. Seemed to be all clear now. David's free and Saul will never bother him again. But it was a short while after that that Saul was after him again. The ambivalence of Saul is seen back and forth, up and down. But it's this demented person, Saul. We've seen him in his demented state, in fury and in a time of rage when he would seek David's music to soothe him. And finally, David's music could no longer soothe him. Jealousy prevailed within him. And now he's after David. Well, so there'd be another time that he would be after him again. Now, let's look at chapter 26, verses 1 to 25. Another time, tell us about.
Apparently Saul was after him again. And David found out where he was staying. He sent some scouts out to find out exactly where he was at. And the following evening, he took one of his, Abishai, took him down to where Saul was staying, and Abishai wanted to run through with his spear, with Saul's own spear, but David instead took his spear and just used it to prove that he was down there the next morning, and the next morning he accused Abner, his bodyguard, of being poor guards, and just made it clear that he was there and could have killed Saul, but he didn't.
He showed Saul twice now that he could have killed him, but he didn't. And that should have been a lesson enough to Saul, that it was not true, evidently, of what people were reporting about David, that David was out to kill Saul and to take the kingship away from him. But Saul didn't accept all of that proof. At En-Gedi, and now out on the battlefield, when they were sleeping at night, he crept on to the battlefield, the campsite where Saul was, and he spared his life. En-Gedi is an interesting place on the border of the Dead Sea. You remember in Palestine, Galilee, the Jordan River, and the Dead Sea. And here is the wilderness of Judea and the Mediterranean Sea, and Jerusalem is back up here. Well, here on the border of the Dead Sea is a beautiful little oasis. It's in a canyon back away from the Dead Sea. I remember back in 1971 when Rose and I were with a archaeological study tour group that we made our way over to the Qumran community where the Dead Sea Scrolls were located here at the north part of the Dead Sea. And then we went down south a little bit and we went swimming in the Dead Sea, which is an interesting experience. You can lie on the water and just lie there and float. And it looks like over half of your body, a good half of your body, is above the surface of the water because of the heavy mineral deposits in the Dead Sea. In fact, we saw where the Israelis had... they had dammed off a part of the Dead Sea, and what they would do was to let the water pour over into this part down here, and then they would block the dam here, and it would all dry up. And when it dried up, here were these heavy mineral deposits all over the bed of the sea, and they would capture them in this way. Well, here along the shore is En-Gedi. And we left our bus out here near the lake, and we walked way back here in the canyon. And there is a beautiful waterfall back here. Water coming out of the wilderness, and about 40 feet in the air. It falls from a distance about 40 feet in the air and down to this canyon. Well, it was here in this area that numerous caves on the hillside were located. And it's thick with greenery in that oasis spot. And when we walked back there, and then especially when we came back, you could even today see caves in the hillside. It was here that David was hiding.
And one time he would be here, another time he would be over here, another time here. He just had to constantly move around. He couldn't stay in the same place. The famous spot is the cave of Adullam, where he was hiding from Saul at the time that God met him in a new way. I remember that day, it was so hot. It was the hottest day of all. And in the Dead Sea, which is below sea level, it's so hot in there. We were walking along back up into this canyon, and one of the old Southern country preachers said, "It's so hot, the sweat, the perspiration is pouring down my legs like sweat." You know, you're not supposed to say sweat. Perspiration is a more dignified word. But he said it's pouring down like sweat today. And when we got back up here to this waterfalls, there were some people who had come up into this area, and they were wading in the pool that was there. And some of our young people were wading, and some of them just clothes and all went in. It was such a hot day, they enjoyed it. Well, I pulled off my shoes and I pulled up my pants leg a little bit, and I was wading in just about that deep. And I looked across, and you know, you can kind of catch when something is up. There was one of the guys in our group who was quite a cut up. He was coming toward me, and he was looking like this, and then looking over at somebody else, and then looking back at me. And another guy was coming from this direction, and he was looking at him, and then he was looking at me. And you know, you just kind of get a sense of things, that something's about to take place here. Well, I checked out across the water and made my way away, lest I be head and all right in that water there. But I managed to escape, like David managed to escape from wicked Saul when he fled from him here at En-Gedi and in all the rest of the wilderness, where he was for 10 years fleeing from the wicked hand of Saul. Now, David trusted God's providential care. He was determined to become king in God's way. In fact, his attitude is revealed in 1 Samuel 22, verse 3. Look back at 22, verse 3. Now, one occasion, you remember Jerusalem is about here, we said, and Bethlehem is south of it, over on this side of the wilderness. And his family was at Bethlehem, but he feared for his family's life. No telling what Saul might do to his own family. So he took his mother and his father, and he took them away from there, and he took them over to Moab, over on this side of the Dead Sea. Now, do you remember who came from Moab, who was a relative of David's? Ruth. And I checked it out. She was the great-grandmother. I was not sure last night whether it was grandmother or great-grandmother. She was the great-grandmother of David. So he had some family ties there. He went over to the king of Moab. And this is what he said in 22, verse 3. He said, "Would you let my father and mother come and stay with you until I learn what God will do for me?" See what David reveals in that statement. Until I learn what God will do for me. That was David's attitude during these 10 years of fleeing from Saul. Not, I must kill him before he kills me. But instead, I will not touch the Lord's anointed. I'll just escape from him until I see what God is going to do. And the day came when God, in his providence, allowed the enemy to take Saul from the scene. And it was a judgment upon Saul, because Saul had rejected God. Now God had rejected Saul and turned from him. His protective care would no longer be upon Saul, but it would be upon David. And David rested in faith, saying, "I'll wait to see what God is going to do for me." Why Saul's ambivalence? And the next point in our outline, why was Saul up and down, one day changing? Well, the Bible says, a double-minded man is unstable in all his ways. Saul was an unstable person because he didn't follow the will of God. And young people, we find this in life. If we're going after our will, And we're trying to hold on to our will while at the same time seeking to do as much as we can with God's will, while at the same time holding on to a few things that we desire for ourselves. We will be ambivalent. A double-minded man is unstable in all his ways. You cannot serve God and mammon, Jesus Christ said. For either you'll love the one and hate the other, or it'll be reversed. You can't straddle the fence with Jesus Christ. No man having put the hand to the plow and looking back is fit for the kingdom of God. Go all the way with Jesus Christ. All the way. Be a disciple. Take up your cross and follow me, Jesus said, or you cannot be my disciple. Well, Saul was ambivalent. And we can expect this of an ambivalent person who is double-minded and unstable in all his ways. You can never expect a rational action from him. And so you can't expect it from Saul. But there seems to be something that caused Saul to be ambivalent in his way. As David wandered about as an outlaw, what was it that caused Saul, when he saw good and well that David wasn't out to kill him, and he would say, David, you are a better man than I am, as they yell back and forth on one of those occasions you spoke about. He would yell back and forth, and David would say, Saul, why do you seek me in this way? And Saul would say, I don't know, David. I've been a worse man than you. I'm sorry. I'll never do it again. Well, the second time it happened, and David said, I have your sword out here. Saul, in effect, wanted him to bring it to him. And David said, send one of your men out to get it. Even then, David was suspicious. And he had a right to be, because Saul was ambivalent, and he would change. Well, there's a clue given to us in one of the Psalms that David wrote. Look at Psalm 7. Psalm 7. Now, in Psalm 7, there is a superscription given to the psalm. That's a little inscription that's written above the psalm at the beginning. Sometimes it's included in your translation. Sometimes it's not included, because these were not in a part of the inspired scriptures. But the superscription says, a Shigayon of David, which he sang to the Lord concerning Cush a Benjamite. Now David is singing, and he's singing concerning Cush the Benjamite, who evidently was a soldier in Saul's army. And what does David say in this psalm? Well, look at this psalm. And you'll see that David is saying, the Lord is protecting me against my enemy. When my enemy pursues me, he'll not overtake me. God is going to protect me. Now look at another psalm that David wrote, probably during this period of time. Psalm 24, a psalm of David. And look at verse 9. Excuse me. 1 Samuel 24. We're referring back now to 1 Samuel 24 that this psalm probably fits with the historical background. 1 Samuel 24, verse 9. He said to Saul, why do you listen when men say David is bent on harming you? This day you have seen with your own eyes how the Lord delivered you into my hands in the cave. Now there is a hint on what was happening. Someone was feeding false information to Saul, telling him that David was after him when David wasn't. And David is saying, why do you believe these false reports? And this psalm indicates, Psalm 7 indicates, according to the inscription given to it, that Cush the Benjamite must have been one of those who was the enemy of David and was giving such false reports. And the psalm appears to indicate that. It alludes to that type of attitude that was shown toward David. Well, that must have been the reason for Saul's ambivalence. he would work up a good case against David and go after him. And then David would show that he wasn't after Saul. And that Saul would retreat for a little while, and then these would feed their false reports to Saul, and Saul would say, "That did it, let's go after him." So he'd be back after David again. And that didn't stop until Saul himself was killed in battle later on. Saul's ambivalence led to David's fleeing for 10 years during a time of tribulation. 10 years of tribulation is our last point. And during this 10 years, David wandered about like an outlaw. In the end, he escaped into the obscurity of refuge in the land of the Philistines, the enemies of Israel. The only safe place for David was outside of Israel, in the land of the Philistines. What an agonizing and heartbreaking decade that must have been for David as he fled from Saul. And we might ask the question, why? As we said, there are those why periods in our lives. Many Christians pass through them. The period is unexplainable. We look at it and there can be no objective reason we can see for why that should be happening to us. No rational explanation for it. And even Christ experienced that kind of thing when he took our place for us on the cross of Calvary. We many times ask why in our lives, but there was only one time that the Messiah ever asked the question why. And it was when he was experiencing our suffering for us on the cross. He was experiencing such an agony of torment and punishment for man's sin that as he entered into all of our human experiences of woe and agony, suffering for us on the cross, he cried out, "Why hast thou forsaken me?" He experienced the experiences of man. It's the only time when he was experiencing his life as Messiah, fulfilling the task of the Father, he never asked the question why. But when he entered into all of our woe, it shows us the extent to which Christ went in his identification with us on the cross of Calvary. He cried out, "Why hast thou forsaken me?" And why had God forsaken him in that moment? Because God cannot stand the sight of sin. And God turned away from sin as sin was being poured out upon Christ, our sins laid on him, and the wrath of God was being poured out in punishment for sin. God is just and the justifier of all who believe on God through Christ. And in the moment in which he died on the cross, he was satisfying the justice of God that demanded that sin be punished. And at the same time, he was satisfying the love of God that demanded that an atonement be made that he might save man. Mercy and peace are met together. Righteousness and truth have kissed each other at the cross of Calvary. Why hast thou forsaken me? He was bearing all of our woe, all of our agony. He was experiencing what David experienced during those why periods of his life. But during these periods, God did some wonderful things in David's life. He enabled him to build up an army. But more than that, David's character was being formed. And that's what God uses difficult periods for in our lives, to shape our character and to mold us after the character of Christ. And when David came into the kingship later, you see what would have happened if David, as a young man, had been anointed there in Bethlehem and then right away picked up and put on a throne and made king over all Israel? David could have turned to pride. He would have not have known that building of character in his life that it took those 10 to 15 or 20 years for God to do in preparing him for the throne. David might have been like the little woodpecker I've heard about, who was pecking away at a giant tree in the Sequoia National Forest. And as he was pecking away at a little inch of that tree, lightning struck. And it struck that tree, and it felled the tree. And for the rest of his life, that little woodpecker went around bragging about he had felled a giant tree. Well, now, if David had been placed into the kingship, the rest of his life he would have thought, look at me, look what I've accomplished. But God took him through those down periods in order that when he brought him to the up period in his life, David would do what David did do. He turned to God, and the Psalms that he wrote during these periods indicated over and over again, Thou alone, O Lord, hast done it. He would give the glory to God because God had done it. Psalm 34 he wrote during this time. Psalm 18 he wrote during this time. And Psalm 52. And these Psalms reveal such words as this, Thou, God, hast done it. You've brought me to this place. And how often we've comforted ourselves from these Psalms. The Psalms that are written during this period bear four things, chiefly. They tell us about doom, and then prayer, and then God's deliverance and praise. Four themes run through these Psalms that were written during this exile period. Doom, prayer, deliverance, and praise. And David, when he came into the kingship, said, Lord, you've done it. The kingdom is yours. I give the crown to you. And that's what David did when he became king. He said, Lord, you deserve to be the king